Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRue Show for Saturday, June 7th, 2014. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. Today, our topic is that we have a report from the High Plains in the United States on the question, focused on the question, where is your food going to come from? Now, I will introduce our guests in a minute, but I just a point of geography here. I hope everyone has in mind the world crisis that's embodied in the terrible drought in California, the terrible drought in Texas, and elsewhere in the western states. But we have our three guests today. None of them are from California, but the point is still the same. We have a national and international food crisis because of what's happening with agriculture, industry, and the whole economic base of the United States. So we have two guests from the Northern Plains who are hooked in by telephone. I'm very glad. By the way, they're both, of course, west of the Mississippi River and in southeastern South Dakota. We welcome Ron Wieczorek. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Marcia.
And from a little east of there, right, Andy Olson is in southern Minnesota. Hi, Andy.
Hi, everybody.
And both of these gentlemen you've heard on this show before and maybe known about because they make a way of life of raising a ruckus in their respective state capitals and the nearby states in order to, they've been leading the charge, Ron and Andy, for a sharp policy break with the destruction of our economy, especially out there in the plains, that they're going to describe in just a minute. But I've invited especially to speak about West Texas from the southern high plains there, and in fact, from the panhandle of West Texas, Bob Baker, who spent a month there in April on the Keisha Rogers for Senate campaign. Welcome, Bob.
Hello, Marcia.
And he's here in the studio with me, and I have a few words of introduction, but one thing about West Texas panhandle area, if you visualize it on the map in these famous name towns, Amarillo, Abilene, this was the epicenter of the 1930s drought. Some of you may have seen the public broadcasting movie called Dust Bowl, I think, and just northwest of Amarillo was Dalhart, which was a center of this movie, but this is an extreme situation. Now, the point about all this is that the entire food production capacity of the United States, which was the man-made, which was created by man's intervention, high technology, and so forth, is now in crisis and is in the process of being taken down. Now, this is the result of financial flim-flam, speculation, the Chicago Merc, and also the lack of infrastructure for reliable water, reliable transportation, and reliable supply of inputs. You'll hear more about that. And also because the impact of Wall Street, City of London money decisions has now really all but taken over the processing of our food. So we, the eating public, are paying more by the day. Farmers are more and more in a precarious, uncertain situation. And this amounts to what you could see as bail-in in action. We've heard a lot in recent years about the outrageous bailout of our federal money to select banks, mega banks, Wall Street. But in fact, our means of existence is being bailed in to these, is being taken away from us and given to the same financial networks. Now, I just want to say one thing before we go right into these, our guests kicking off the discussion, is we've had a national and international intervention against this process of destruction and bail-in, led by two political candidates in California, Texas. I'm sure you who are listening, most of you all know them well. On May 27th was Keisha Rogers' Democratic primary vote in Texas, and June 3rd out in San Francisco was Michael Steger, her teammate's primary for the seat that Nancy Pelosi's held for 27 years, and Keisha Rogers and Michael Steger in these respective places, working together out in the West, have had a fantastic impact that goes way beyond the votes that day. You know, we've had their campaign, Michael himself and people from their campaign, on this show in the last 3 weeks. But just to summarize, Keisha Rogers got 28% to 30% of the vote, but believe me, the irregularities in withheld vote are glaring. I won't go into them now. Michael Steger had a couple of percentage points of the vote cast in San Francisco, but had a fantastic impact on all the constituencies that make up that international Pacific Basin town. I mean, Chinese, Vietnamese, Russian, Hispanic, a fantastic impact, and they're going to continue to lead the charge for the break in policy, that Obama should be put out of office. We should restore and unleash the American system. That'll mean doing things like reinstating the Glass-Steagall Act and having credit to intervene on our power and water base of our nation in order to create the means to life again. Now, I just want to say one thing about the backdrop to all of this. It's all part of the fact that the longer Obama's in office, I hope some of you may have seen him yesterday in the photo opportunity in France, where he was standing right next to Queen Elizabeth, chatting away for the 70th anniversary of the Normandy invasion. And that visual makes the point. He has been leading our nation with this classic British geopolitical warfare drive, where you have, you've seen it over the years, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, now Ukraine. These are interventions to upset the government, have strategic so-called revolutions, people's revolutions, color revolutions, and the Mr. LaRouche, or the LaRouche Political Actions Committee, is in the process of releasing a statement on that, making that clear over the next, you'll see it posted over the next 24 hours. I'd like people to watch out for that, because we are joined in this battle. Congress is going to be back in Washington, D.C. by in the next couple days, by June 9th. Keisha Rogers, I think, will be giving them what for sometime in the next 10 days in Washington, D.C. Come and visit there. So stay tuned on all of that. And with that said, let's just turn now to our topic of the situation out west, west of the Mississippi. And what we're going to do is start with a panhandle where, as I said, Bob worked on Keisha Rogers' campaign. And if you begin by just bringing out some things about the condition that you found, and the physical condition in the Panhandle area, and your time there, the people you met, and so forth, Bob.
Well, I think one of the striking things that jumps out, and Andy and Ron can understand this, is the magnitude and power of the U.S. agricultural industry as a food-producing machine across the nation. And when we were traveling around the Panhandle, which is the top 26 counties of Texas, and it really jumps out the power of man-made technology to take an area that's would be next to a desert and turn it into a flourishing food production area.
You mean the topmost northerly counties?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The irrigation systems that were put in to, you know, grow all kinds of crops, and cotton, corn, etc. But the from driving around this area, what you see is major things jump out. In many areas, just hundreds and hundreds of windmills have popped up. Oil wells sitting all over the place, which, okay, we need oil. But water transport semis going up and down the road, wherever you go, you see all the infrastructure to support the fracking, which in many parts and communities is the boom and a very major source of income now. What's interesting, if you take get on the computer and do a Google map search, put it on satellite, and zoom in on some cities like Seminole, Texas, or La Mesa, or Denver City, or even areas around Amarillo. What you'll see is you'll see all these little circles, and these are irrigation systems that are have been put in over many years, most of which are supplied by water from the Ogallala Aquifer, which they have many test wells they monitor over each year, and they're finding areas where the water tables in the Ogallala has dropped up to 19 feet.
A year, you were saying?
A year. And so this is a shocking thing. Lubbock, for instance, the water is so short there that for the first time in history, they are recycling wastewater. I think it's the first city in the nation that's actually recycling their wastewater.
Yeah, I think Wichita Falls is going to do it mm-hmm. direct. Lubbock may be putting it in an intermediary.
So the with all these discussions and water looking, facing everybody in the area, again, if you would look at it from a satellite map search, you zoom in on a city like Seminole, Texas, and you'll see all these irrigation circles, 640 acres, maybe 500 acres in a circle, 200 acres. But you'll also see all these little dots right around the city. It's almost like a grid, little white dots. And if you zoom in on them, these are all fracking holes. And they all have roads connecting them. And you almost look like you're looking at grid paper. So it really jumps out at you that this is a massive infrastructure input, but each one of these holes may be a mile deep. They got drilling a hole 12 inches in diameter, a mile deep through solid rock or cement, just to visualize, and then you stick a steel pipe that's about a half inch thick. The rim of it is maybe 10 inches in diameter, and you screw these together. They're like 30 foot lengths, and you stick them down a mile deep, and then you stick another pipe inside of those that's very thick, maybe 8 inches in diameter, and then you fill the space, the hollow space around each pipe and around the hole with some sort of a cement mixture to suppose. The idea is to seal up the hole so that any of the gas that would come back up would not enter into the soil and contaminate other water sources. Well, this is going on by the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds all over these cities, and people are very concerned. So now you've got to participate in all these hundreds of fracking holes. Semis hauling water all over the place. So there's big transport. So you can be driving along and you'll see whole fields with chain link fences around them with just, 50 or 100 transports sitting in them that are, moving water and different things around. Big semis with dual engines they're pulling around on the semi bed to pump the water down into these holes in order to fracture the underground rock formation so that the gas can percolate out. Now that's a contrasting image to looking at the farmland, because it's in Andy and Ron see this up in their area, but I was really impressed with how flat the panhandle is, and you could drive like 50, 60 miles or longer. It's just almost perfectly flat, and farmland on all sizes as far as you can see, and cotton, some corn, but in particular, because it's a dryland farming area, they have to use a ridge till type tillage operation, where they pull an implement through the land that builds ridges maybe 14 inches tall and every 18 inches, so the ridges are 18 inches apart and with a valley in between them of about 14 inches. And they try to till at horizontal to the prevailing wind. Now, why do they do that? Well, there's several reasons. Because, for instance, with cotton, there's a lot of wind, and that's one thing that just really stood out in my mind was every day it was like 20 to 35 mile an hour winds, day after day after day. And these fields are just laying wide open. So there's a lot of dust blowing. We did get caught in one dust storm that was, it was amazing. I mean, it was like it was snowing, you know. I mean, you couldn't see. People had to turn on their lights. You see dirt drifting like snow drifts in the fields. In some cases, it was even almost up over the fence posts. And so these ridges are put in the field, and farmers have done it for a long time because when the wind blows across them, it starts the soil particles spinning, and the idea is the ridges help keep the particles from being blown away so that they fall in the depressions. Also, when they plant the cotton, they plant it at the bottom of the ridge in the depression, because the early plant, when it gets up 6-8 inches, is very vulnerable to sand and wind blowing. So it protects it until it, you know, gets taller. It also helps conserve any rain that they get to increase the moisture level. So you see that contrasting for mile after mile after mile, as far as you can see, ridge-tilled land to produce cotton connected to a man-made irrigation system that's putting water in center pivot irrigations on top of the land. But also now there's many underground micro irrigation going on, which is very expensive, but very people are doing it. So in this kind of an environment, you see the manifested the tremendous technology that human beings can do to increase the production with this kind of irrigation. But also, it also brings it to the point that the water in the Ogallala is getting down, and we got to get more water in there. So people were wide open to the discussions about NOAAPA and the processes we need to get an economic recovery. You know, we had meetings with people every day, and people were really, because there's such a density of, let's say, the workforce in the fracking industry. They understand machinery. They understand how to build stuff, how to make things work, and they're tremendously open to discussions of modern technology. They're not married to the fracking. They'd love to see nuclear power built, you know, fusion energy. So they was open to all that kind of technology. But that's a real powerful thing. You're driving to see all this food production technology. You see the windmills, you see the oil wells pumping all over the place, and then you drive through a lot of cities and you see this extreme poverty, where you could tell it was a city that, a small town that was very productive, but now you see in many cases the gas stations on all four corners of an intersection are shut down. So you see building after building boarded up, or for sale, or for lease, you know, in a drive-through, a main street with four lanes of paved street, but buildings everywhere, you know, for sale or lease or for rent, which indicates that, you know, there was something much more there than just the fracking and that kind of production at one time, and that's where people were open to the discussion about, let's get the financial system reorganized around Glass-Steagall, and, you know, what's really causing this kind of shutdown. So that's sort of a brushstroke of some of the things that you saw, you know, and we ran into from a physical side.
And let me ask just one thing before you, just based on what you said. Also, you saw a lake that was practically not there anymore, or if you look on the map, West Texas is where the Texas-Colorado River rises. There's a Colorado River in Texas that goes rises in the west and goes down to the Gulf. It goes through Austin, the capital, and there's so little water there that the rice growers south of Austin have been there for 100 years. They don't have their water allocation. But I understand where you were, there was nothing in the river.
Well, yeah, we were invited out to a ranch to discuss the water crisis, and the gentleman directed us to his property, and he said, well, you go so far and you'll cross the Colorado River and then you turn right. And we kept driving and we didn't see the Colorado River, and finally we called him and he said, I forgot to tell you, there's no water in it. And so, I mean, that's, you know, it's just not no water. There's just weeds everywhere. I mean, it's just like nothing there. It's like there never was a river. That's how dry it was. I mean, this is an area of the country that's got about 17 people per square mile population density. So it's not very populated. But
yeah. Well, let me ask then, Andy or Ron, the one thing is this gives us a vivid picture. And of course, this goes with the fact the last few years, you've seen this drastic reduction in the number of cattle in Texas, the wheat decline in wheat production this year, including up through western Oklahoma, western Kansas. But so you have all this, but it's not just that. You're up there in the northern plains, and you still have water running in your rivers. But you have so many factors also contributing to the agriculture and food crisis where you are. Do you want to go through that? Do you want to start, Andy?
Well, I just look at the financing of agriculture. We've had many cycles where agriculture has been pretty good, and then the famous one when Paul Volcker raised the interest rates to 19% and maybe a little bit higher. That just collapsed agriculture, and we had this major crisis in the mid-80s of, you know, farmers were forced off from their ground. They were they couldn't obviously pay their interest on their loans and so forth. And so there was a real changeover in financing. And there was a FDR, Production Credit and Federal Land Bank, which financed agriculture, as well as the cooperatives, which were formed in FDR's time period also, the Capra-Volstead Act. But what happened then is that many farmers were forced to sell out, and farm credit had never foreclosed on farmers to this scale. And so they were forced by the Federal Reserve to do this. And what happened, essentially, that the farm cooperative system was bankrupt, especially the finance end of it, the PCA and the Federal Land Bank. But interestingly, a lot of small commercial banks did go under and were absorbed by other independent banks, but the farm credit system never went bankrupt, which was strange because they were bankrupt. But what happened is that Wall Street picked up the farm credit system, and today it's known as a government-sponsored entity. And this now is a very thorn in the side of the small-town independent banks, in that with this government support and Wall Street's backing, they pretty much moved out of their old facilities, and all these new, it's called AgStar now, facilities were built. This is now undercutting the small commercial banks with their easy financing, the lower interest rates, and so the small banks are struggling. And we're going to see a further consolidation of this. And I don't think many people realize what did happen, that the farm credit system then became a bigger presence, but yet it's not to control the farmers anymore. It's Wall Street right in the middle of all these towns. And so I I emphasize the finance part of agriculture because it's a big part of agriculture. And then we've had the environmentalism with, like Bob mentioned, all these wind towers. We have them here on some of the best farmland in the world. It's just like it's cluttering up the landscape, and I don't know why farmers, I mean, they hand them a little money, and they get a return, a small return, and so they, in a sense, diminish the productive value of their land by, I mean, there's roads that come in and they put in a few hundred yards of cement to erect these things, and then they have to come in with heavy cranes, and they don't last very long before they have to be fixed. I mean, it's a real primitive type of energy. So I just emphasize that part of agriculture. Another part is animal agriculture that, especially in the beef and cattle, where because of the shrinkage of the cattle herd from like 140 million back in the 60s to under 100 million and dropping today, and that has resulted in shortages, and it's just, we've seen a doubling of price of beef and on the way to almost tripling it. And I don't see any way that it's going to be arrested because there is not enough beef. Where's the beef? And, you know, also we have a lot of hog production, and that's been impacted by disease this year and so forth. So the ethanol plants have taken a lot of the feed, so that's put pressure on the animal agriculture that needs the feed, and we're burning up our food by running it up and down the road in the gas tank. It's just, if you wanted to design a policy to destroy American agriculture, that what I've just kind of talked about is really what has been a very negative impact on agriculture. But, you know, some of the farmers have benefited from high grain prices, and, you know, then the land price has inflated. It's unbelievable what the price of farmland is now, like $10,000 an acre. You just can't support it, you know, very easily at that price. You have to have some pretty deep pockets. And it's highly risky. And this is what's happened in America over decades, is that the prices go up, and then they come back down. We have a panic, you know, the famous panics in the 19th century. This is all because of the policy of monetarism. And farmers are conditioned. They're sort of like, oh, boy, the prices are good. But just you wait, look out, it's going to, and sure enough, the sledgehammer comes down. And then farmers end up with all kinds of financial distress and so forth. If we had a credit system, we wouldn't have this part of our economy that is so uncertain and so speculative. So I'll just stop at that, and I'm sure Ron has some observations too.
Well, yeah. I was just thinking about what Bob was saying about Texas down there, where they're using the water for fracking, you know, and the results of that has been about an 18 to 20% drop in the cattle numbers in Texas alone, and the effect on the dinner table has reached almost a panic state in the price of hamburger and beef. And the other aspect of that is in the irrigation system they have down there. When they were putting the water out on the open land, the added moisture in the air would help the surrounding wheat crop produce. I just talked to a family member I have several family members that are in wheat harvesting business, and they normally go into Texas this year, but only one of them out of the three went down into the Texas area this year. And a couple days ago, I was talking to them, and they just finished a 700-acre field that made 3.4 bushels an acre. they were just moving into another field by the combine monitors that was estimated to be making about 11 bushels an acre. So the wheat production there is probably 5 to 10% of what it normally should be in that area. So you can see what's happening to our food production in an area where the water is being wasted for, you know, a non-essential energy source, or to provide us for a non-essential energy source, where we should have been going with Kennedy's 1963 fusion energy program and Eisenhower and Kennedy's New WAPA project to bring water down into those areas. If you haven't got at least 50% of your economy working and building for the future, you're going to go backwards, and that's what this country is doing right now, and we're sacrificing people's standards of living and even their lives on a surviving food system. But another thing up here in South Dakota, you know, the last several years, we've been very fortunate, and we've had a very decent crop up here. Of course, the high-priced corn and high-priced soybean, they took and broke up all the pasture land that used to produce cattle in our area. And then last winter, we had a severe storm that took out a large number of the cattle West River here in the snowstorms, where they smothered to death and they couldn't, you know, get to them and recover them. Anyway, the cattle number in our area has collapsed too, and now we have like I think Andy or one of the gentlemen was mentioned that the price of cattle are 2 to 3 times what they were. Well, they're about 3 times what they were. So if a young man wants to get into the cattle industry today, he really can't afford it, because these cows are running around $3,000 a head. And I mean, there's just no way that the credit is available for these young people. And basically what we've created is a system similar to what the Jefferson and Jackson economy created back in the 1800s, when they moved with a plantation system. And then, of course, that collapsed, and Abraham Lincoln come in with the American system and put people back on the farms with the Transcontinental Railroad system, with the Homestead Act, and, you know, putting a town every 12 miles out here and putting the land in the hands of as many people as you possibly could. And, of course, then after Teddy Roosevelt come in, we had to switch back to the plantation system. And in the 20s, teens and 20s, we ended up with a bonanza farms in the North Dakota, again, which were nothing but plantation systems. And then we had Roosevelt come in, go back to the American system, which Lyndon LaRouche has referred to often and is the only economist that really represents it today. I mean, put people back on the land, you know, in the 30s with a new credit system. And with a goal of building infrastructure, building the water and hydroelectric plants that were necessary to develop this area out here. The Missouri River Basin, was a fantastic project that was shut down in the 70s. I mean, if we would have continued on that, when we finished the Waukee Dam up here in the Missouri River Basin, if we moved with the New WAPA, we would have an area now in the southwest part of the United States where we could put another 500 million people. I mean, that would give our kids a future. We would have a totally different environment and a totally different economy than we have today if we had followed through with the correct American system policies. So that's and another thing up here in South Dakota, because of the lack of transportation, the lack of infrastructure, we've not been able to get a bumper crop out. I just had a government official interview me here a couple of days ago from the Department of Agriculture. She brought up over here at Emory, South Dakota, where there's several million bushels of corn piles on the ground. Two piles with several million bushels in them. The plastic covering on it in the storm that you just had was torn off, and they got like 3 to 9 inches of water on those corn piles. Out at Kimball, South Dakota, there's probably, I'm just estimating here, but it's millions of bushels of Milo laying on the ground yet that should have been moved and either consumed or turned into ethanol or done something done with. I mean, they are now trying to buy up, you know, quality Milo around the country so they can mix with this rotten pile of milo they have on the ground. I mean, these insane kind of situations that we've created here in the agriculture sector is unreal to me. And it's too bad that we haven't got any politicians that can relate to that in Washington, D.C. I just got an email here this morning here from a friend at UR in South Dakota that is a great supporter of the Democratic Party. But his note to me was how fed up he's with the Democratic Party, and he's talking about Tim Johnson here and Senator Mike Crapo. I think that's how you pronounce it. It sounds like a good name for
He says Crapo, but you're right, I'm sure, from where is
from
that? West.
Idaho, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they're introducing legislation to privatize Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And this is the same thing that they want, you know, that Andy was talking about, what they've done with the agriculture sector and the farm credit system. I mean, they want to do this to the housing industry now. So, and they've already raped the housing industry as far as that goes. So if we don't get back to what the American system is, and another thing I might add, I just run across this morning, was if people would go to type in the president of Russia, you'll get Putin's website. And I think everybody that's listening to this call should take the time to send that man a note of thank you for adopting the American credit system and telling him to help educate these fools in Washington to what the American credit system is, so we can get this nation back up and going, so we can put Russia and China and India and the USA on the road to victory against the British Empire.
I just want to jump in because Ron and Andy, you guys are right on the mark in terms of discussing this credit and how this thing is now in its final lap of consolidation. I mean, a report just released shows that at the current rate of depletion of the Ogallala Aquifer, in the next 20 years or less, we could lose 35% of the irrigated land that it's now irrigating. And that's a major chunk of our food production. But getting into the privatization of these income streams and the credit systems, like in agriculture and stuff, I mean, there's discussion that this is part of what's driving this whole VA scandal in terms of trying to privatize even the
VA,
Veterans Hospital System. But two other aspects I just want to throw in here is, and this is, in driving around, you can't go anywhere in the nation now without seeing something popping up on all the streets. It's called title loan companies, bright yellow, or they call it paycheck loan companies. And you go to any city, and the intersections are just covered with people holding up signs, twirling them around, get your paycheck loan. So people walk in, they get they make out a check and get a $500 loan, but as soon as their paycheck is deposited, they got to pay for it. Now this is hedge fund driven, according to people that have been looking into this. So here you've got the derivatives crowd and these people getting ready to squeeze the last ounce of credit or debt out of the poorest people. With through their what's left of their cars and their paycheck loans, out of desperation, they don't even have enough to get by from month to month. So you look at this dynamic and how the quantitative easing that the Federal Reserve has been pumping in, $85 billion a month last year, and now it's phased back to about $55 billion. But what's this doing? it's driving a certain element into savings. And you see, the interesting thing about a bank, it must, if you go in and put a deposit in a savings account, by law they have to take that money. Now for a bank, that's a liability. For you, that may be an asset, you got savings in the bank, but they don't want that. That's why they don't pay any interest on it. But the other dynamic is the loans that and especially the local banks, the small banks, they don't have the credit to make loans, and that's their assets. That's how they stay in business. So you've got the small banks now, lending is going down. The savings, people don't want to put it in anything. They're scared about any investment. And so their liabilities are going up. So the quantitative easing actually hurts and is increasing the destruction of what's left of the smaller rural banks and local banks. So you put all this together with, you know, what you're saying about the consolidation of food production into the mechanisms of bigger corporate control and not providing water and infrastructure enough to make that all work, you can see that now we're coming to sort of the cliff.
Well, let me ask the three, since we have the three of you on here, and you can spell this out for the non-farm, those not in the know on the farming side, but we all eat. I just want to stress again, we have another 20 minutes, another third of the show, but I was looking at every once in a while there's a national report call about meat, about what's in cold storage. This is a guesstimate about what's in reserve. It's not reserves on purpose, but it's in inventories and storage. Hams, bacon, beef. And the cold storage numbers, let me just say, take hams. What's in storage now is 35% down from a year ago. It's 13% down from the five-year average. Same thing with beef. Beef inventories, all kinds of cuts, are down 21% from a year ago, 11% from the five-year average. And I know any one of you could say, you can't make this up next year. You can read the financial, you can watch financial TV and say, oh, this is a great incentive for ranchers to produce more beef, but you don't snap your fingers. Ron, right?
Right. Well, you just made me think of Plato's cave, the shadows on the wall. I mean, what they're holding up to these people is, you know, a dollar reserve or your security is the federal crop insurance. What happened to a food reserve? Let's get back to reality. Let's say get a food reserve where we can take care of people if we have a major crisis. You know, we just had a big rock coming in here tomorrow. It's going to miss the planet, of course. But this thing is like 3.5 blocks wide in diameter. What if this was a direct hit on the Earth? I mean, how much of the production of the world could be just wiped out overnight? And we sat here with pieces of paper that we're going to eat. Let's do what we did in the 50s and the 60s. Let's have a food a reserve, you know. Let's have canned meat put away. Let's have this stuff stored up. Let's have this reserve so we have true, real security rather than this fictitious stuff on the wall that seems to tantalize the mind of these modern-day idiots.
Yeah, right.
Excuse the language, but I mean, it just frustrates me when I think about the potential risk that we're putting the people in the cities, on. And back to getting young people into this game again. I mean, there's so many people my age that are ready to, quit, and nobody's going to take over my place. I've got no kids that are going to be involved in farming. So some bigger operation is going to take over. And I mean, it's this idea of bigger, bigger, bigger is not the solution. It's the same damn thing with banks, too big to fail. Farms are supposed to get too big to fail. That's nonsense. That's some more shadows on the wall of Plato's cave. I mean, we've got to get a classical education into these people so they can think. We've got to flank them with classical music. We've got to flank them with classical literature so they can use their mind like a human being again to help us get out of this mess that we've gotten ourselves and the nation into.
Right. Well, Andy, you've spoken about the age of farmers, but also could you say again and the years it takes to build up a herd?
Oh my! If Ron is correct in saying it costs $3,000 to buy a bred heifer, that's a lot of money. You used to be able to buy a bred heifer for $500 in the lean times.
Andy, the first heifers I bought, I paid $141 for.
Well, it shows you how bizarre this thing is, that inflation is just wild in agriculture, and you know that you have to feed that animal, and it gestation is 9 months, and then it takes 12 to 15 months to feed it out. So, I mean, this thing isn't like Marcia says, you just snap your finger and the beef is on the table. This is a infrastructure that is very delicate in a sense. But we had a lot of density of production that's been taken out. And, you know, a lot of this pasture land went into the relevant state departments of natural resources. These people are in charge of our natural resources, and really, they're not. They're destroying our food production. And they're coming out of the colleges and have degrees in environmentalism, and they have no clue of the priorities that the country needs. But this is the policy of the empire, to promote environmentalism and reduce the world's population. And what we're talking about here is policies that will reduce the population of the world. And when you throw in this fracking business, it's such a mirage. In our area of the United States, most all the refineries have long-term contracts with the Canadians. So this new crude in the Bakken formation and so forth, there's no place for it to be refined because refineries are set up for the heavy Canadian crude. And tremendous production is occurring in North Dakota. I think they've reached 1 million barrels of oil a day. So the scheme is for the crude to be exported, and then the gas that's produced at these wells, they don't have the infrastructure to capture it, and it's flared off. They say you can look from the satellite photo, and it looks like North Dakota is heavily populated because of all the lights at night.
Looks like it's on fire, huh?
Yeah, it's literally on fire. So the big motor behind this is the Crown companies out of Canada. Enbridge, which is a big pipeline company that is building the infrastructure and that controls the infrastructure. And we've had pipeline in Minnesota that was reversed to feed this, to bring the light distillates to dilute the heavy crude so they can pump it back here. It's unbelievable. I would think that Americans would, at a certain point, stand up on their hind feet, but they've become so impotent, and you know they're scared. So, you know, the people like ourselves and co-thinkers have got to inspire Americans to remember what we used to be, and that we can set up a credit system, and we don't have to be living under the boot of empire, because that's what we are right now.
Right. Can I ask you, we have enough minutes, Andy, you're up there in Minnesota, and could you explain, because it has to do with agriculture too, the way then a great deal of this oil, the crude from the Dakotas, has to go by rail. Warren Buffett is the biggest hauler. And you see it where you are, and then the sand going the other way for the infrastructure. Could you just give an idea of what that meant over the last few months,
Marcia,
for agriculture?
Marcia,
yes.
Marcia, could I
yes.
interject a point here?
Yes.
This boom bust cycle that they've taken with the price of our land, you know, in the last 10 years, the price of the land has probably gone up 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw in the Dakota Farmer the last quarter of last year and the first quarter of this year, there's two areas, the southeast part and the east central part of North Dakota, where the land values have started to drop, and they were blaming it on the collapse in the corn market and the sugar beet industry up there. So, I mean, even though North Dakota is supposed to be this wonderful economic example of activity, I mean, there's signs of the bust up there already.
Well, because they can't move anything, right? Is that part of it?
Well, the other aspect of it is this insane drive to bring this outside money in, driving up the price of this land. I mean, for these young people can't afford to get in anymore. You can't pay $10,000-$15,000 for land up there in the Red River Valley and ever expect to pay for it, or even come close to keeping a cash flow going that'll hold your head above water.
The railroads are what is supposed to help us out here as far as moving all these bulk commodities. But then now we have the fracking, which is called for a lot of this sand that's mined out of Minnesota and Wisconsin, the silica sand, which is combined with the water and the chemicals, which they fracture down in the pipe a mile underground. And the trains that are running through my hometown here, I would estimate that at least a third of the transportation is sand cars from mines right along the Minnesota River, and it's a major Belgium company. I think it's the largest Belgian company and one of the richest Belgium families in Belgium, and it's called Uniman. And they have these huge mines, and so on a daily basis, hundreds of sand cars are moving down to the Permian Basin, the Niobrara in Wyoming, and down into the Eagle Ford, and I think they're even going west of the east of the Marcellus in Pennsylvania.
Wow!
They're upgrading rail so they can. Well, they've destroyed the rail infrastructure, and now they're kind of band-aiding it together to facilitate this. So it's I don't know, it's the Keystone Cops out here that they don't know what they're doing.
We had quite a crisis here in South Dakota with the EB-5 program, which was a loan program that, they would go to foreigners from China and Korea and Japan give them a lifetime green card if they invested $5 million in some industry in South Dakota. Well, here in South Dakota, they had driven all the farmers, all the dairy farmers off the land, and then they come in with this program and brought Chinese and Japanese money in here to finance people from England and California to set up a major big dairy farms here, but plantation dairy farms. And they've done the same thing with the packing plant industry here, and there's been quite a scandal around the money, bringing this money in. So I don't know what's going to come of that, but again, that's the lack of not having supervised national credit available for infrastructure and manufacturing and agriculture.
Yeah, that's right, Ron. And in the Panhandle, they had a news report about a big company from France that's buying farmland all over the Panhandle.
Yep.
Right. Well, one thing is, this is in contrast, one of you or more mentioned in the last hour, the initiatives we hear in just, it's almost by the day, but in recent weeks, new arrangements signed between China and Russia for joint development in the Arctic, in terms of nuclear power, in terms of space, in terms of natural gas pipelines, not to flare it off for a couple of years of Wall Street gain, but for use in an economy that is going nuclear and is going into high technology. Do you, in your respective localities, I know you, it's not as if you live in a highly populous area of the country, but you've been in touch with networks in these farm states and bring up some of what is going on in the Eurasian development perspective. What do you find in the way of reactions? Have you done that, Ron, or have you been, I know you've been sidelined for a little while.
Well, I was sidetracked here for a minute. I didn't hear the first part of your comment there.
No, I was just saying you might get
track.
No, I was just saying, Bob spoke of getting reactions in Texas, West Texas, and elsewhere to the whole prospect of we ought to be going nuclear, conceptualizing problems with a way to solve them instead of just dead-end hope for a job for a couple years.
Definitely here in South Dakota, I've seen more activity on the part of people that are becoming concerned mm-hmm. about the crisis. And it's just like this, lady from the government that was doing this poll on me the other day. I mean, we ended up 3/4 of our conversation was about what's wrong with our government and what can we do to fix this thing. And most of my doctors they didn't want to put me to sleep because they wanted me to give them a lesson on when I was having surgery. They didn't want to put me to sleep. They wanted to give me a spinal so I could talk while they were operating about the politics and the economics of the situation. So I definitely see major concerns in people that understand that there is some people out here that have put an effort into figuring out what's wrong and what needs to be done. And I think that's the major importance of this organization. I mean, the dedication of the people in the organization is unbelievable to me, and the efforts that they put into it and the leadership that they have shown, especially in these last two campaigns, is inspiring people all over the country and all over the world.
Right.
And you see, like in West Texas, what you saw happening in these communities, that's why you see all these empty buildings, is the young people are leaving, and the what's left is older people, and there's no way to maintain that, so you're not replicating things. They're moving into the cities like Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, Fort Worth. Their populations are growing, but this masks the decline of the rural West Texas population. And here you got all this fracking and the oil booms and the windmills and all this stuff. It's not doing what's necessary. It's on the wrong track, but at the same time, it's still not maintaining a population.
Right.
Right. And Andy, you see the same thing, I'm sure.
Well, I'm convinced that a short term that these windmills will not be viable, and the farmers will either have to deal with this abandoned obelisk out in their field, or they're going to have to tear them down. But the strategy of the empire is to use this, which is draining our resources, to build this primitive energy, and it's just really to destroy us. We should be going on to the nuclear and the fusion, and it would be so much more beneficial to our economy. You can't imagine what the benefits would be compared to this primitive stuff. And then these generators break down and they're 300 feet in the air. it does not make any sense at all. But I guess
I'm very afraid that we're going to end up in a similar situation to what they were in Russia in the 90s there, when there was hardly any food. I mean, that the grocery stores were empty of food there for a while. I think that's what's going to happen here. And if people don't turn towards Linda LaRouche and the organization, I think we're going to have a very drastic, severe crisis. And I pray to God that we can come out of this, and pray to God that our leadership can somehow manage to get these people moving on the right track. Otherwise, it's going to be devastating for the American people.
Well, I think history shows that it can happen, because, like you mentioned about Lincoln putting in the Greenback policy, the Homestead Act of 1860, that kind of policy, and our policy around Hamilton, it got transferred into Germany, into efforts in Russia, into Japan, into China, and all these great industrial upwellings took place. But the empire always tries to get those areas in war with each other, like right now, so they can't develop. And that is a great awakening that we're bringing to the population through this whole drive.
That's very important that the American people understand that, and somehow we're able to get that point across to them.
Right. I think we need to close now, but I think you've raised a wonderful irony that the initiatives that we see from Russia and China together, there's a new leader in India, they are going towards and implementing aspects of the American system. So we ought to have a leg up on that. We know about it, some of us, and that's the irony, that we've got to bring it back here, even if we have to do it via Eurasia. And I want to thank you all very much for raising that. We want to get together again soon. So Ron Weisswerk in South Dakota, Andy Olson in Minnesota, Bob Baker, who's here in the studio but was in Texas with the Keisha Rogers campaign. Thank you very much. This is the end of the June 4th, 2014 LaRue Show. Thank you all.
Thank you, Marcia.
Thank you.